you are standing and confessing this is both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say Black Lives Matter rather than All Lives Matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. My guest today will be Dr. Stacy Patton, an assistant professor of multimedia journalism at Morgan State University in Baltimore, Maryland. She is the author of That Mean Old Yesterday, a memoir, as well as Spare the Kids, Why Whippin' Children Won't Save Black America, and the forthcoming book, Strung Up, The Lynching of Black Children and Teenagers in America, 1880 to 1968. Dr. Patton's reporting on issues of child welfare, race relations, and higher ed has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Baltimore Sun, Al Jazeera, BBC News, The Root, The Chronicle of Higher Education, ForHarriet.com, and Dame Magazine. Today, I'll be talking with her largely about the issue of corporal punishment, and especially its application and justification often offered within African American communities, and what that says about the power of white supremacy and the reality of racial disparity in America today. But first, a few thoughts. So last year, when I was approached by my guest today, by her publisher, actually, and I was asked to read through her new book about corporal punishment, and if I liked it, to provide a blurb to the publisher endorsing the book, I was all too happy to do it. And yet I was also a bit conflicted, because I realized that over the years, I had made certain comments about the subject of corporal punishment, and particularly in the black community, which is what she describes and discusses at length in her book, that could have been, and often I think were, misinterpreted as somehow excusing the practice among black folks because of the rationale that is often offered. Back in my first edition of White Like Me, which many of you, of course, will know is my first book, my memoir, I told a story which I later removed. The reason I removed it was because of this fear of misunderstanding. The story involved a workshop that I had been in many years ago, and we were having a conversation. I was leading this discussion, and we were having a conversation about the issue of white privilege and the way that it manifests in things like parenting and things like schools. And I happened to mention that growing up in Nashville, Tennessee, my parents had always been very clear. This was in the early to mid-1970s when I was in elementary school and middle school, where corporal punishment was in the South and still very much is a common practice. My parents had made it very clear that I was not to be subject to it. I was not to be physically disciplined, that no teacher, no principal, no advisor, nobody was going to put a hand on me in the schools. And so they had written a letter to that effect, as had some other parents, to essentially opt out of this otherwise normative practice known as corporal punishment. And I made the point in the workshop that the only kids whose parents had signed a letter like that, instructing that there be no corporal punishment meted out on their children's behinds, had been white, and they had been sort of white, hippy-dippy liberal parents like mine, and that black parents, who no doubt did not like the thought of white, mostly, teachers or principals administering such punishment to their children, nonetheless had acceded to it. And I was trying to make the point there were a couple reasons for this, right? Number one was the feeling that they wouldn't be able to effectively go against the administration, the feeling of powerlessness, which often is a result of being marginalized. And so the fear that as black parents, their concerns about corporal punishment would have fallen on deaf ears, which of course means that in a sense, my parents and I as their child were engaged in white privilege in the sense that we felt as though our objection to this otherwise normative policy would be taken seriously and respected, and that we wouldn't be looked at badly for it. But I also made the point that, well, actually what I did is I asked the participants in the workshop, I said, why do you think it is that Black parents, generally speaking, not only in this one experience in Nashville, but according to the research, which Dr. Stacey Patton will talk about today, are oftentimes more willing to allow corporal punishment against their children in schools and to mete it out themselves as parents? And there were all kinds of people trying to offer up different guesses. White folks were saying things like, well, you know, Black folks are more spiritual and maybe they take the Bible seriously about spare the rod and spoil the child more so than white folks. And, you know, then some other folks were saying, well, you know, maybe it's just that the Black folks are on average, maybe they haven't read the research, you know, they haven't had access to all the research that demonstrates that it's dysfunctional, you know, and it's not their fault for not knowing it. These whites always wanted to point that out because they didn't want to sound racist when they said that. And I mentioned in the story that there were a couple of Black women in the room who the entire time that these white folks were offering up these supposed reasons for why Black folks were often quicker to jump to corporal punishment than white parents were, they just sort of smiled and they were laughing the whole way through. And finally, I called on them. And these women essentially offered up the same story that ultimately the reason that they often used corporal punishment was because of a concern that if they didn't figure out a way to break the exuberance of their Black children, that somehow the state or agents of the state, as in police, would end up doing it for them. And I wasn't telling this story as an endorsement of that mentality. In fact, I thought I made it clear. I'd have to go back and look at the original story the way I wrote it. But I'm very clear on the dysfunctionality of this practice. And I'm certainly very clear on the fact that decades and generations of corporal punishment being meted out on the behinds of Black children by Black parents has not obviously prevented mass incarceration. It has not prevented a situation where police are 3.2 times more likely to kill unarmed Black folks than unarmed white folks. Obviously, police brutality and disproportionality against Black folks is still being meted out no matter how many behinds are getting tanned or belted as children. So obviously I know that this is not a good excuse or a good reason, but I was trying to demonstrate by telling it that there was a certain kind of privilege in white parenting that, you know, our white parents don't have to think about that, right? That my mom and dad didn't even have to cross their mind, right? That if they don't break me of the natural exuberance of youth, that somehow the state is going to do it, and they're going to do it in a far more dysfunctional way. And even though I wasn't trying to defend that answer as a good answer, I did think it was important for the white folks in the room to think about what it means that Black parents are actually thinking about that. And thinking about it in a way that still leads, in my estimation, and according to the research, which Dr. Patton will talk about today, to a very dysfunctional practice. But I do want to still, as I was trying to say in the original version of the story, those of us who are white, to think about what it means that Black parents will make that argument, right? Because white parents who use corporal punishment, let's be clear, there are a lot of white parents who still do. This is not just a Black thing. I don't want it to seem that we're pathologizing the Black family, because God knows white folks do enough of that and this country does enough of that, and I don't want to add to that. This is not just a Black thing. But the Black rationale offered oftentimes for doing it is interestingly very different. You know, white folks who still spank their kids, and I know plenty of them, usually don't offer the same reason. Usually they'll try to come up with other reasons that are just very straightforward. Like, you know, they'll say the same stuff. Oh, I got spanked as a kid and I turned out okay. And they'll say things like, well, you know, there's certain things for which there's no other appropriate punishment. You've got to get the message across or whatever. You know, they'll come up with all kinds of things, but it's really only in Black communities and communities of color that you'll hear this argument about needing to break your child so that the cop won't do it, or so that other, you know, agents of the state or authority figures or whatever won't do it. And that speaks really to the issue that Dr. Stacey Patton talks about so eloquently in her book, and the thing that drew me in when I was asked to read it and did read it and ultimately did blurb the book and endorsed it wholeheartedly, was that she makes it very clear this mentality that justifies the whipping of children is the mentality that justified the whipping of children by slave masters and justified corporal punishment being meted out by Black parents to their children on the plantation so that the overseer wouldn't do it worse, so that the slave patrol wouldn't do it worse, so that the master wouldn't take it out on the backsides of those children and those families. And of course, the great irony is that that overseer, that master, that slave patrol, they would still take it out of the hides of those Black children and families, no matter how harshly the Black parents punished their kids. So it didn't deter that mistreatment any more than doing it today deters the mistreatment at the hands of police. But yet, of course, the thinking still persists. And as much as that thinking is clearly dysfunctional, and we're going to be talking about that throughout the course of this hour, it is still important to recognize the deep systemic pain that produces that mentality. It is important to place that mentality in its proper historical context, to understand the way that terror felt by Black families, terror which led them to believe that if they just disciplined their children a little more harshly, that the master, the overseer, the plantation owner would go easier on them, is really at the root of the crisis. That's why Stacey Patton says that whooping Black children may in fact be the whitest thing that you could do. It's a comment and an argument that she's gotten a lot of pushback for, both from Black folks and from white folks. And we're going to be talking about that today. Reading her book was a hugely eye-opening experience for me. I think it will be for you as well if you grab a copy of it. It's a lot of things to talk about. So we're going to be talking about that today. I'm not going to offer any other commentary on the week's events. We have a lot of discussion. I want to leave most of it in. Didn't want to edit it out. Let me first of all say up front, I want to apologize for the audio quality in this particular episode. When Dr. Patton and I had this conversation, she wanted to, and I thought it was a great idea, and I thought it was great the way it worked out, wanted to live stream the conversation on Facebook Live. And so we did it as a Facebook Live stream, which doesn't always produce the greatest sound quality. Future episodes will have better sound quality. Hopefully it won't be too distracting. Most of it, I think, is still pretty clear. I think you'll enjoy the episode, and thanks for listening. So what I wanted to do first, before we get into sort of the conversation about corporal punishment as policy, sort of the more political and ideological piece, I know that for you, Stacey, this is not some abstract academic issue. This isn't just something that you decided, oh, I think I'll go research this, or I find this interesting. This is deeply personal for you. And I know your first book, That Mean Old Yesterday, where you talked about really your own story. And so it's a deeply personal thing. And I think it's important for us to connect our biographies to our politics and to our professional work. And you've certainly done that. So could you share with the listeners how you came to understand at a very deep, visceral level the importance of addressing the way that we so often abuse children in this country in the name of quote unquote love?
So as you indicated, this is deeply personal to me. As someone who grew up in an African-American adoptive family where spare the rod, spoil the child was a Bible verse that was often wielded to justify what was happening to me. Racism was also used, often invoked as a justification for being whooped. I was 5 years old when I came to live with my adoptive parents. And I had never been hit before that. And so the first time I ever got hit by this person who was supposed to love and protect me, it was shattering to me. And so I everywhere I looked within my community, at church, Black comedy, people often talked about whipping children and that this was part of responsible Black parenting. And so my adoptive mother always said that, you know, if I don't whip you, then you know, the police will beat you worse or kill you. The white man doesn't want you to thrive in society. You'll end up in jail or an early grave, all of those sorts of things. And it just didn't connect for me as a child because the only person I thought was going to kill me was my Black mama. And so that was like the sort of personal beginnings of that.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until graduate school that I started making the scholarly connections.
I gather from some of the research, and of course you present a lot of really important informative research in your book, but I gather that there's something that happens when a child is on the receiving end of that abuse, especially when it's couched in love. There's got to be some type of psychological almost dissociation that you go through. You're trying to rationalize these professions of love, and yet the person who is professing to love you engages in this brutality. That has got to do something to a child's mind, even how they understand love in a partner later, or even how they love themselves, right?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of science that speaks to this. I would say in the last 10, 15 years, neurobiologists have been studying this, looking at the impact that spanking, not even severe abuse, but just spanking has the development of a child's brain, how it changes the chemistry And the actual physical architecture of a child's developing brain. So what ends up happening is that the messages of pain and love sort of coalesce and become embedded in that prefrontal cortex area of the brain. That's why so many people grow up to invert this kind of violence as something that's good. There's all this research that shows that people who experience, who witness domestic violence, you know, parent, one parent hitting another parent, they're able to grow up and see that that type of violence was bad.
Yeah.
But that's not the same thing that happens when it's your mother or father spanking you and saying that I'm doing this because I love you, giving you a hug after. It's a kind of brainwashing. It has implications for, you know, what people consider to be a loving relationship later on in life. It primes them for aggression and domestic violence, you know, putting them at risk for abusing their own kids as well.
Right. And I know that there would be some people out there who would say that, you know, well, there's a difference between, you know, a swat on the butt, right, spanking, and actually, you know, beating. And they would draw this line and they say, well, what I do isn't abuse. But of course, I know you don't buy that distinction and you talk a lot about why you don't. Tell those who are listening why you don't believe that there's this line between, you know, sort of abuse and real abuse that people try to draw oftentimes as a way to rationalize what they're already doing.
Yeah, they play semantics, you know, they use words like spank, pop, will try to make themselves feel better about the violence. It's just all semantics. I always say the only, you know, difference between all of these things is the spelling. It all involves, you know, when you're intentionally striking a child's body to cause pain, it involves violence.
Yeah.
It involves pain. And all of it puts a child at risk for the same kind of negative karma. Yeah. Once again, I go back to the science. There's been, you know, some professionals at Harvard have been studying, you know, brain scans. And these are people who are not severely abused, but just were spanked, like regular swats on the backside. And they're those scans, they compared them to people's brains who were not hit. These are young adults. And what they found was an average of 20 to 30% reduction in the prefrontal, in the gray matter in the prefrontal cortex of the brain. So the brain tells that story. So some people think that, you know, abuse is when you, you know, you leave marks or bruises,
right,
or, you know, a child is dead.
Right.
But the brain tells the story of abuse, whether it's severe and leaves a mark or it doesn't.
Right, right. Now, you mentioned a second ago that your mother would tell you, and this is a very common refrain, you're certainly not alone in this, that if she did not do these things to you, that somebody, the white man or a cop, in particular law enforcement is often the story that we hear, that, you know, if I don't do this to you, they're going to get hold of you. I have to sort of break you before they do. And it's a very common thing. And I would imagine that in many cases, and obviously I wouldn't pretend to speak for your mother in this situation because that could be a very different situation. I'm sure there are people who say that. And they have the best of intentions, at least they feel that they do. But it seems to me that there's a real disconnect, right? Because on the one hand, folks are saying, you know, if we do this, you won't get in trouble with the law, you won't get locked up, you won't get shot by a cop. And yet black folks are being locked up at disproportionate rates, and they are being shot 3.2 times more often than whites, even when unarmed. So something, if this is what's supposed to work, it clearly ain't working. Like, something is happening between the time that you're getting popped and the time that you're getting stopped by the officer. Why do folks, you think, still hold on to that as a preventative when they can look around and see very clearly, I think we all can, that it's not preventing what it's supposed to be preventing?
So I hear this all the time, you know, and often tell people that if whipping children was so effective at keeping black people safe from police brutality and keeping them from prisons, then why are we having a national conversation about these issues?
Right.
People are not well-versed in the historical origins of the rise of the carceral state in this country.
Right.
You know, I've screened Ava DuVernay's The 13th 4 times now,
yeah,
and she beautifully lays out that history. And that it is a industry that is driven by corporations along with, you know, government backing, right? That this is about the continued exploitation of black bodies for profit. Whipping your child is going to save them from that system. And so when you are a people who are under siege for generations, generation after generation, dealing with trauma, dealing with, you know, institutionalized racism and all of these traps, it is very easy to misconstrue brutality and violence as love and protection. And it really scapegoats, you know, it uses our children's bodies as an altar for all of these structural issues, rather than striking back against the system, rather than waging war against the system. It's much easier to do it to a child that can't strike you back. And so when you also are a people whose identity, really believe that, well, I'm not in prison today, I'm not a crackhead, you know, I haven't fallen victim to any of these traps, like so many other people I know, then it must be because my mama whooped me. Right. That's what saved me. And what people don't realize is that it co-signs a very racist narrative, a long-standing racist narrative that says the only way to keep black people out of jail and to keep them out of trouble and to make them good, productive, thriving, healthy citizens is to process their bodies through violence. Right. And the people really believe that they wouldn't have turned out fine without all of that violence.
Well, and of course, it's highly selective social science anyway, because if I'm saying the reason that I'm not in prison, the reason that I'm not dead is because I was whooped, but then somebody else who is in prison, who most certainly was whooped, you know, I'm not saying that being whooped is why they're there, but it clearly didn't stop them from being there, and alternative, more humane punishments clearly are not causing them to go there. So at some point, that person could say, well, if I'm saying the reason I'm not there is because I got whooped, then how do I explain the one who is there who did? I mean, at some point, you can't look at the one side of the ledger and not look at the other side, and yet that's what we do. And I think your point that you just made is very profound, because I think it is in part what a person does or what a people do when they are disempowered, when they are marginalized, when they are oppressed. You will take any feeling of power that you can grab onto, right? And so if you're, whether it's a person of color under white supremacy, or working class white folks are far more likely to use corporal punishment than affluent folks, when you're poor, even if you're poor and white, right? That is a feeling of, it isn't real power, but it's a feeling of power to be able to exercise control and domination. So the most out of control, unpowerful people will grasp onto that. But like you said, that's not really altering any power dynamic.
Slavery created a kind of elusive black parenting, right? So here they are, these people don't have ownership over their own bodies.
Right.
Don't have ownership over their own children, can't even name them in some cases. They don't have the, any sort of control over their children's destiny. They could be taken away from them at any time.
Right.
But the only real power that overseers and slave masters allow black parents to have over their kids is to beat and distort them, to prepare them to perpetuate this cheap labor force system. And that kind of elusive parenting continued after slavery during Jim Crow and continues even now.
And that gets into this issue of blackness per se with, and the history of this with regard to black people, because I do think that there is this assumption, and it is an overgeneralization of biblical proportions, that corporal punishment is sort of this, that it is this quintessential, almost essentially black thing. And as you talk about in the book, and I've seen you interviewed elsewhere and you talk about it, that the irony of that is this is so not a black thing that it's actually, and you said today, in fact, I saw it on your Facebook page, that that whooping your children is about the whitest thing that you could do to a black child. Explain that. Talk about that, because I don't think people know where this practice really comes from. It's not African.
Yeah. So I hear black people say often that, you know, people around the world for all time have been hitting children. It's absolutely not true.
Right.
Researchers are pretty in, you know, agreement that this is a practice that emerged in European cultures. And so Europeans have been traumatizing their kids for thousands of years. I mean, just awful stuff. They didn't even recognize that children were children until about the 16th century. And it's at that precise time that you also begin seeing this these theft of bodies from West Africa. And so they needed to come up with some language to describe these Africans that they were bringing here. And so they called them children. And so they modeled their brutality of Africans on pre-existing versions of brutality that they meted out onto their own kids. But then they had a problem. They said, wait, we can't have white children occupying such uncomfortable close proximity to these African children. So they began to slowly rescue white children from the brutality of the kind of brutality that they experienced prior to that. They were still being abused after that, but not to the same degree.
Right.
So then I have black people who say things like, oh, we bought whipping children over from Africa. And I say, well, what evidence do you have? There's absolutely no evidence of this. These are the same people who will say, well, white people stole our language, they stole our religion, they stole everything, but whooping ass survived the Middle East. And so I have to explain to folks, when we look at hunter-gatherer societies, where they don't have these rigid hierarchical structures to their societies, there's not that competition, things are just completely different. And they weren't Christians. Our West African ancestors were not Christians. They weren't quoting spare the rod, spoil the child, because they weren't reading the Bible, right? There were no Christians who ended up on those boats. They were either Muslims, worshiping Orishas, and so on and so forth. And so the majority of those captives who were brought here were kids. They were children and teenagers. So these are people who had not completed childhood. It is that process of colonization, Christianization and slavery and a long history of racism that altered the way people parented. Black parenting became something else on this side of the diaspora. We also didn't see this type of thing going on with indigenous people, Native Americans here, prior to colonialism as well. So we did not believe that our children were born in sin, in that whole Christian ideology. They were reincarnated ancestors, that they were gods. They were spirits. They were powerful. You would never hit a child because that diminished you as well.
So in a lot of ways, this is tied to both European heritage and culture, but also very specifically to this sort of Christocentric view of mankind as evil. And so to carry on a practice that is rooted in that, in the name of blackness, is especially ironic, obviously. But also it speaks to the way in which a certain fundamentalist religiosity rooted in this case, Christian ethics, people being born in sin, people being evil. This is a horribly pessimistic way, obviously, to view human beings and especially to view children. As a dad of two teenagers, if I honestly believed that they were evil and needed to be either beaten or in some other way controlled, I can't fathom how I could be loving parent and bring them to maturity and adulthood with any sense of intentionality. So it seems to me that this is on multiple levels rooted in such a pessimistic view of humanity that it's the kind of thing that, you know, probably should have gone the way of the dinosaurs a long time ago, and yet it persists. And of course it doesn't just persist in black communities, it obviously also persists among white folks. Why do you think it is so hard to get to country, to turn against this practice, given the fact that literally all of the evidence says that it's damaging children?
People have grown up on this from generation to generation. It's been taught in through scripture, from pulpits. You know, it's reinforced through humor and other cultural traditions. It's deeply tied to people's sense of culture and identity.
Right.
And we come and say with all the evidence and say this is harmful, this is wrong, you're basically talking about people's mamas. And when you look at this, the origins of this country, I mean, this country was born in violence. And in order for you to maintain inequality, the system requires that you destroy children. White supremacy is about destroying kids, including white kids. You know, it just doesn't destroy them in the same sort of way that it does children of color. Like they don't get killed by cops, you know, for playing in a park. So they're allowed to grow up so that they can underwrite the logics and horrors of racism. And black kids who do survive the gauntlet of childhood, they too play that part of internalized racism to keep the system, this unequal system, alive and thriving.
Yeah.
You know, if people stop beating their kids, then, you know, people's brains might actually, you know, reach their full potential. Their IQs won't be destroyed. They won't elect people like Donald Trump. They won't be, you know, attracted to abusive, coercive tyrants. People might be empathetic, might develop a sense of justice.
Right.
So the destruction of children is foundational to this.
Right.
And what happens is people are tricked into believing that they turned out okay, right? That, you know, that this was love when it wasn't.
Right. Well, that's the thing. Whenever I hear someone say that, you know, I got spanked and I turned out okay, I always look at them and I go, did you? Did you really? Did you turn out okay? Because I don't think any of us who have been abused physically, emotionally, sexually, mentally, you know, I was never physically abused as a child. I was never touched by a parent as a child in any way that was inappropriate. But I certainly witnessed emotional abuse in the home directed at my mom by my dad. And then, of course, by extension, that bled over to me. And I know that just that alone, even though that wasn't brutalization, physical brutalization, just the screaming, just the knowledge that my father was screaming in the face of my mother in the room next to me, and never knowing whether there was going to be violence meted out on her or on me. Being a kid, knowing the cortisol response, I mean, I didn't know that's what it was at the time, but knowing the stress hormones that were being released in my body to where I would have a startle response to loud noise, right? And I wasn't even being touched. And my dad wasn't physically abusing my mom, but it was just the sound based on the verbal violence was enough. Now you add to that the feeling that, oh, when I hear that noise, I know I'm getting ready to get my ass whooped also. And that's going to be an even greater fear response. I mean, I still do it. I still find myself when there's a loud, when someone speaks really loudly or just calls my name, and not even in anger, right? Just calls my name in sort of a loud voice, that I'll find myself sort of jumping like I don't know what that is. And then after a second, I'll realize, oh, okay, but, you know, that's, and I'm almost 50 years old and I still do that. So I can only imagine what that does to someone who's experiencing that and then knows that within a few seconds there's this physicality that's also coming. I guess the reason it's so hard, and I think you sort of speak to this, that it's so hard for people to turn against that, because even though they know it, and even though everything that you're saying and everything I'm saying makes perfect sense to people when they are not in the middle of being defensive, I would imagine, but there's part of it that says, if I admit that what you're saying is true, it's not only that you're talking about their mama, it's that you're talking about them, because if they've ever done anything, you've now basically called them an abuser. And rather than own that and say, you know what, yeah, I've been conditioned to be an abuser and to carry on that cycle, we would rather sort of maintain our sense of innocence.
It's the guilt. And it's also brain damage.
Right.
So when people say, I was whooped and I turned out fine, or it was good for me, or I deserved it, but to me, that's a sign of brain damage. And I don't say that in a disparaging way.
Right.
Go back to the science that shows that, you know, that gray matter reduction in the prefrontal cortex of the brain,
right,
that's the area of the brain that you need for emotional regulation, for logic and reasoning, and memory.
Yeah.
And so some of these people literally cannot recall the pain, the
right,
betrayal, the hypervigilance, all those things that you were talking about. They literally cannot transport their bodies back to when they were children on the receiving end and be honest about it.
Right.
So that either they can't do it or they don't want to, because it brings back all of these memories that they don't want to revisit.
Right.
They don't want to be disloyal to their parents. And you have a lot of people who are just walking around as victims of unrecognized trauma. And so you have all this stuff in the culture that tells you that it's love, that Jesus wants you to, you know, whoop ass, right? And mostly everything around us tells us that this is right, that nearly anywhere between 70 to 80% of parents are doing this, right? We still got 18 states that allow it in public schools, that this is a solution.
Part of this, and again, I'll tell you, you know, as a white man doing anti-racism work, wading into these waters, I will upfront acknowledge that I'm very cautious about how I get into this conversation about particularly corporal punishment in the Black community, because the last thing I want to do is maintain a dynamic whereby as a white person, I am in any way pathologizing Blackness. Because first of all, that's not what you're doing. That's not what your work does. But I know some people take it that way, right? They view it as, it's almost like the notion of airing dirty laundry, right, in front of white folks. And there's a good reason to be worried about that, because indeed white folks will do stuff with your dirty laundry when you're not white. So how do you respond to those people who maybe from a legitimate place of concern worry about that? And how do you walk a line to make it really clear that this is not about pathologizing Blackness? It's really about pathologizing the culture and what, and in a lot of ways, what white supremacy did to Black folks. How do you deal with that particular kind of critique?
I don't concern myself with right. that anymore. Right. White people, racist people are going to pathologize Black people, whether we talk openly and publicly about our stuff or not.
Right.
So for me, I keep my focus on the fact that, you know, we have hundreds of children who die every single year as a result of a child abuse.
Right.
And so I keep children central to that mission. And, you know, the irony is that, you know, my adoptive mother and all of her abusiveness prepared me for this. There is really nothing anybody can say to me or accuse me of that tops any of the abuse that she put me. So I realized that this backlash that I get is part of changing culture.
Right.
And changing culture is slow.
Right.
And it's painful. And, you know, I just so happen to be one of, you know, many people who are doing this work, and we have to endure this. So for me, I don't get derailed
right.
by the dirty laundry stuff. I don't pay attention. And, you know, it's really sad that we're 150 years removed from the plantation, and the descendants of that peculiar institution look at their own children and say, we need more whoopings. That's just absolutely tragic. And you know, and I'm empathetic. You know, I often say this, that, you know, Black people have been legally parenting their children for 150 years. And during Jim Crow, it's only about 50 years. And it's not like at the end of slavery, you know, as folks were leaving the plantations, there were therapists standing saying, let's deal with this trauma. Let's deal with that rape. Let's deal with the breakup of your families. And let's process this. That's not what happened. So we never got a chance to catch our breath. And, you know, we were always under siege. And during Jim Crow, it became especially dangerous to be a Black child, because now you could be killed. You can be lynched, right? That's what my next book is about. It's about the lynching of children. You know, and so it was real. The fear was real and never ending. And so when Black parents today read about a Tamir Rice or a Mike Brown or Freddie Gray, you know, Latoya Graham's cry was very real. I didn't want my son to turn out to be another Freddie Gray. It is very real. And so people draw on that and say, see? But the reality is this. Once again, when we look at the statistics, right? So I gathered data on fatalities, child fatalities in Black communities for the past 10 years. The number is close to 4,000 Black children have been killed by their own parents and caretakers.
Yeah.
Now, if you put those numbers next to police fatalities, and this does not excuse people killing, you know, police officers killing kids, right. the numbers pale in comparison. So the reality is that Black children are more at risk of being seriously injured, assaulted, or killed by their own parents and caretakers, the people who love them, then they are a cop. And it's really tragic.
Well, and both of those kinds of killings, in a way, are part of a larger system of the dehumanization of Black bodies. So they come from a similar place. And even though very few Black parents would ever feel, obviously, on a conscious level, that they were doing the same thing as the officer or doing the same thing as the overseer. But ultimately, that thing that allows that officer to shoot Tamir Rice in 1.5 seconds in that park in Cleveland, that thing that allows that officer to you know, choke the life out of Eric Garner on the streets of Staten Island, it's rooted in the inability to see those individuals as human beings, as full human beings. And when a parent brutalizes their child or spanks their child, obviously they don't think they're not human beings, but they are acting in a way that is rooted in the diminishment, if not the utter dehumanization, the diminishing of their full humanity. And both of those things were taught by white supremacy. Cops, white or black, were taught that by white supremacy. And so I think what I found so profound and helpful, really, in this dialogue about your book is that it does create that systemic connection, because otherwise it's just a self-help book. But there are lots of books like that. What we don't have are a lot of analyses that tie together individual behaviors that are dysfunctional and root them in something deeper. And I feel like that's usually what's missing in all of our conversation. We don't see systemic links. And so mm-hmm. that's what I think is so important about your book. Now, I saw something today online, and I wanted to ask you about this. So apparently, and I didn't know this, you had a speech earlier in the year at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. And this was a speech that had a bunch of sponsors. I mean, it had like six or seven different organizations or sections of the school that were sponsoring it. And I guess a few of them, three of them, I think, decided they had to pull their sponsorship because the title of your talk was too provocative, controversial. What got them so on edge? And what do you think that was about?
So the title of the talk was, you know, killing black children is an American tradition. And so they had these flyers that they made, and there was a short description about how I was going to be talking about the historical devaluation of black children through science, through medical practice, and so on and so forth. So they, you know, put these flyers up on campus. People were tearing them down. This is why I always chuckle when the right wing complains about, these crazy racists, anti-Semites who come to campus, and yeah. folks rebel against them, and they say, oh, there's censorship and stuff like that. But this happens to those of us on the other side all the time.
Right.
They tear down flyers, they don't get the word out, or they pull funding when they don't, when right. you know, a title makes them feel uncomfortable. And so it was the Family Studies Department, journalism, and I don't remember, I think it was media studies or something like that. And so they pulled the funding, and one of the professors, who knew nothing about me, nothing about my work, said that it was a clickbait title.
Right.
And then she assumed that it was going to be a speech that, you know, inflamed people. And so it caused a great deal of controversy. So they pulled their funding. So when I got there, there were graduate students from those departments who actually apologized. And so I went on with the talk. I pulled straight from the archives, not from, you know, my ear or whatever. And there was no controversy. The historical archives spoke for themselves. But we are living in an age where the racists are now people like you and me who talk about racism.
What I find interesting about that title and that professor calling it clickbait, not only is that sort of dismissive and offensive just in itself, but it also suggests that that professor has no understanding of the history to which you were going to speak, because really that title, though it is a provocative title, there's nothing about it that is historically inaccurate.
I just laid out the history of how the life moments of children get seized and used to set social policies around education, medical practice, child welfare, juvenile justice, and in particularly when you're looking at Jim Crow, how it also led to the lynchings of children. I just laid it all out, and that what happens is that these disciplines need to grapple with the historical foundations and how the development of their disciplines move through the language of race, power, and privilege. It just was so baffling to me to have journalists who do media and family studies and training, you know, people how to be culturally competent and so on, could judge a title and say, no, we're not going to talk about that. We're going to shut that down without having any other knowledge. But it speaks to the ways in which the right wing has aggressively colonized. You see these right wing, news outlets who put professors on watch lists. This is why I'm glad I work at HBCU. They call, they try to get me fired. They'll see if I write something on social media, the PR folks will tell me, yeah, you know, people are, who'd you piss off on Twitter?
Right.
What did you write this week? Because we got all these calls. I mean, and it's really, I mean, the, and they absolutely think that they can pressure presidents and board of regents into firing us. And certainly there have been instances where professors have been removed, or have been subjected to all kinds of harassment on their campuses and totally thrown under the bus by college presidents.
Right.
Because they get this pressure from state legislatures and others and just the general public to try to shut down conversations about race.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you alluded there and you mentioned a few minutes ago that your new book that you're working on deals with the lynching of children. I'm interested in knowing a little bit more about that. If you are wanting to maybe preview for us a little bit about what your research has uncovered in that regard, because I think for most of us, when we think of lynching and the history of lynching, with the exception perhaps of Emmett Till, we tend to think of older mm-hmm. adults. But obviously, that's not the full story. So what do we need to know about lynching in America that maybe we don't know as regards kids?
There's historiography on lynching, and as you rightly point out, it mostly focuses on adult black males. And, you know, there's been great scholarship that has tried to nuance how these crimes took place by geography, region, economic circumstances, you know, all of that. And it dawned on me that, you know, there are all of these databases with probably over 4,000 recorded victims' names. I mean, there's tons more, for sure, that their names have been lost to history. And it dawned on me that nobody asked how old the victims are. And so what I've started doing is cross-checking every single victim's name. So I've cross-checked about 200 so far. And of that 200, 92 were age 19 and under. My youngest victim was a two-year-old. I have 5 and 6 year olds being lynched. And the definition that I'm using for lynching doesn't always mean someone's putting a rope around their neck. In some cases, that's true. But this 2-year-old, her father was a postmaster in a town, and you know, the white people were not having it. So they lived above that, the post office, and they set the place on fire. The father runs out, they strung him up. The mother runs out with the baby in hand. They actually shoot the baby out of the mother's hands, right? So I'm using the NAACP's definition of what constituted a lynching or mob violence in the name of justice or whatever. I have situations where siblings were lynched. One case in Salisbury, North Carolina, where 4 brothers were lynched within 2 years of each other, 2 at a time. I have of the 200 names that I've cross-checked and the 92 kids, 23 of them are girls. So it's a book that doesn't just say, well, black children were lynched also, but it asks deeper questions. How many? And that number matters because I'm batting close to 50% right now. If I find that a significant proportion of the victims were kids, that changes the historiography.
Right.
And it goes right in line with what I've been arguing through all of my work, is that the destruction of children is central, fundamental to white supremacy, right? And so I'm looking at the reasons why they were lynched, who were the participants. The news articles often name the accusers. So when you get to like the 1940s, 1950s, and Sally accused Tyrone of, you know, assaulting her and he's killed, where is, you know, Sally today? And, you know, looking at the impact that it had on the communities that these children belong to, on the parents, how did they deal emotionally with this? How did it alter parenting? And the bigger connection is, look, if we were to understand Tamir Rice, Mike Brown, Trayvon Martin, and the fact that over the past few years, we listened to grownups debate whether unarmed children deserve to die. We need to ask, where did this come from? We have to go back to this moment in American history to see how this particular moment was foundational to what we're seeing today.
Well, going back to the parenting piece really quickly before we're going to wrap up. So for those people who they listen to your interview here and they think, you know, she's absolutely right, and we got to do better, and maybe I got to do better, and I want to parent differently because I realize that this is wrong. What are some things that you recommend, or ways that you recommend parents who really want to parent in a responsible and a truly compassionate and caring way, but maybe just they don't have any model of that, that's not how they were raised? What are the things that they can do, and where are the resources that they can get out there, or that you can help steer them to, so that they can go in that different direction and not feel sort of unmoored?
The first thing that parents need to do is do some work on themselves to reconcile with their own childhood. They have to be honest about their own childhood. You know, if your kid is acting out or crying or whining, and that incites you to be violent with them, ask yourself, well, why? What is my fear? You know, what's this about in terms of my own ego? If I was raised in a house where if I stepped out of line, I got yelled at, threatened, or even hit, a lot of times what the parents are reacting to with their own kid is their own past, because they knew that moment of acting out meant impending violence. And so they're repeating that cycle. That's step one. Then there's all kinds of stuff out there. Free parenting sites. They can go on my site, sparethekids.com, where I do weekly parenting tips, videos, and so forth to help people deal with those day-to-day moments. A lot of people don't understand enough about brain development. So what's appropriate for a child to do? That your kid is not being willful, or it's not a devil. Right. It's just normal. If they can understand that children's brains are in process, their brains are like mush, and so there are tons of things out there, positive parenting, peaceful parenting, that gives parents these practical daily tips that they can use. And it's out there and it's free. And there are tons of books. And so if you can understand what's going on in your child's brain, then you can develop empathy. So discipline is about teaching and guiding a child through their problems to help them solve a problem, not punishing them physically for having a problem. Right. And I think people need to educate themselves about things like cortisol and oxytocin, right, and epigenetics. And ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, and chronic stress, and how those things may have impacted their own life, their own emotional health as well, and not put their kid at risk for those same types of outcomes later in life. What we really need in this country is a universal parenting program to educate parents about the science, about this historical stuff, and then the, stuff that can go wrong later in life when you're, assaulting your kid's body.
Well, and I think some of that parents need to learn, we also need to be making sure that teachers know some of that research, because even if they're not using corporal punishment in the school, I think all of this sort of goes back to our desire to control children. Because we view them, as you said, as willful, and they have to be broken of bad habits, like it's your dog who peed on the furniture. Parents and teachers, oftentimes, they want to maintain control and order as just, calm and peace and quiet. And that's why the teacher wants all the kids to sit in rows and be quiet and raise their hand and don't speak until they're spoken to. And it's the reason some parents want the same thing, rather than sort of knowing how to deal constructively with the chaos that is a two-year-old. When my wife and I would take our kids out to eat really early on, and everybody would always talk about how well behaved they were. But if they got out of line, we weren't going to yell at them. We were just going to say, you know what? It's not the time. We're not going to eat out tonight. No big deal. But I see all the time parents who, even if they don't yell at their kids, you just know that they have no internal locus of control to sort of calm themselves. And so part of this, whether it's teachers or parents, like you said, you've got to really get in touch with whatever it is that hurt you. Mm-hmm. That, because hurt people hurt people, and that's what we see in these cycles of abuse. I guess the final thought would be, Where do you see this going in 20 years, in 50 years? Do you think that we are moving in or have a decent chance of moving in a direction of more compassionate parenting? How long do you think it's going to take for us to get to a point where something like corporal punishment is seen as barbaric?
So we're at 54 countries that have banned corporal punishment. You know, Sweden started this movement back in the 1970s. So they've seen a whole generation of young people grow up without corporal punishment. And their society reflects that, you know, lower suicide rates, violence, and so on and so forth. Last week I was in New York at a corporal punishment summit, and we had folks from Canada and all across the country developing communication strategy that we hope to go national and then global to do a more aggressive job at, you know, educating people about the harms of hitting. And it was 2 days of just like, you know, hitting the ground, doing this work. And it's gonna take a lot of work to do this. In my cynical moments, when I log onto Facebook and people tag me every day, folks assaulting kids, and I see thousands of comments where people are celebrating it. And it's in those moments when I feel like, oh my God, you know, what am I doing? On one hand, I am heartened to see that there are more conversations about this issue than there was when I was a kid in the 80s and 90s growing up.
Sure.
I mean, we're just really starting to talk about domestic violence. There was none of this discussion. I'm happy to see that happening. My hope is 20, 30, 40 years from now, people will frown at, you know, hitting kids the way we largely as a culture frown at domestic violence among adults. So I'm hopeful. And I'm okay with knowing that, you know what, I may leave this earth and this country still hasn't passed, you know, a law to say that this, you know, this is barbaric. But I'll know that, you know, my work and the work of other people who are doing this has impacted folks, has planted the seeds for folks to change their attitudes and behaviors toward kids.
All of that is long-term work that we just have to commit to and do every day. And the reality is, I think you and I would agree, if we knew tomorrow that nothing was going to change, I mean, fundamentally that nothing was going to change, it's not as if either one of us would just sort of throw up our hands and go, oh, well then screw it. Let's go surfing or something. I mean, you know, let's go bowling, you know, because there's nothing else to do. You do the work because it's the right thing to do.
I look at, you know, we started this conversation talking about my adoptive mother and the abuse that I endured. And for many years, I had to get a lot of therapy to deal with it. You know, I felt, you know, I was victimized. I had a lot of anger over this. And I needed to understand why I was parented this way. And ultimately, I came to the understanding that, you know, this is how my adoptive mother was raised and how her parents were raised and so forth. So I understand the origins. She administered these whippings, but they did not originate with her. They originated with this, you know, this system. And so on a spiritual level, you know, I've gotten to a point where there's nothing to forgive, because that out of my own experience and pain, you know, I survived it. She didn't kill me. I'm able to do this work. And if I had a happy childhood and didn't have these experiences, I wouldn't be so obsessed with this issue. And you know, I'm grateful that I emerged from that experience. And, you know, I tell people I was whooped so good that I decided to grow up to be somebody who spends her life telling people that they shouldn't do it.
Right. Well, that's sort of the ultimate payback, I guess, in a way, right? And I'm, I know I, for one, am eternally grateful for the work that you do. I think it's fantastic. And I'm so glad that we were able to do this for those who are interested in bringing Dr. Stacy Patton to your campus, to your conference, to your community, or bringing me to any of those things. We both work with a group called Speak Out. They are the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau. They've been bringing folks to campuses and communities for over 25 years, social justice activists, educators, and artists, and oftentimes sending us into communities where, frankly, they don't get a lot of people like that. And so if you're interested in bringing Dr. Patton, please contact the folks at speakoutnow.org. Stacy, thank you so much for coming on, and I hope we can do this again sometime. It was great.
This was wonderful.
Take care.
You too.
And a special thanks to all the listeners and those of you downloading the program. Tell your friends and family. Please spread the word on social media. You can find us online at speakoutnow.org/speakoutwithtimwise, also on Facebook at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as Podomatic, the host for this podcast. And if you'd like to become a sustainer and patron of the program, we'd love to have you. It's one of the ways that we can grow the program and make sure that the quality, both technically and substantively, is as good as it can be. There are two ways that you can help us out. One is to go over to patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise and become a monthly sustainer of the program. You can do that at levels of $2, $5, $10, $20, or $50 a month. And with those donations, you'll be able to access premium content unavailable to regular podcast listeners. So that might include extra portions of my interviews with my guests or daily commentaries that I'll be recording at least 3 times a week about the day's events or week's events. Also, at higher levels of patronage, you can get signed copies of my books or videos, all kinds of different extras. So by all means, check that out at patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise. The second way that you can support us is with a direct one-time donation at speakoutnow.org/speakoutwithtimwise. You can do that through PayPal, and especially at larger levels of donation, if you don't want to make a monthly contribution, that's a great way to do that. And there are two pieces of great news when you make a contribution to this effort. Number one, it's tax deductible. The donations are not run through my personal account. They're done through Speak Out, the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau, which has been bringing progressive voices to campuses and communities around the country and really around the world for over 25 years. And secondly, very importantly, we're going to be giving a portion of our monthly revenues to people of color-led social justice organizations because we don't want Speak Out with Tim Wise to just be about the talk. We also want to be about planting seeds, both intellectual and financial, in the soil of the movement. For today's episode, I'd like to thank Felicia Gustin, Jean Kayani, and Amalia Mesa Gustin with Speak Out, my producer, Jamie Lynn Moeller, and Brother Ali for giving permission to use his song Gather Round from his Morning in America and Dreaming in Color album for the intro and outro music for this podcast each week. And that is where we're headed right now. Talk to you next time.
In the fight.